Thank you to all our panelists for those remarks. I do a lot of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking panels, and I think Barney used the word humbled. I'm always humbled by the voices of the people that do this work. But I'd like to start a little bit of a conversation here, and I'd like to touch on something that actually that Michael talked about, and that is the role of men in our work to reduce and eventually eliminate violence against women. And I was wondering if the panelists could think about how we can get men more involved, and if there are any programs that you're aware of that may be having an impact now, any work that is being done. And would, Michael, are you comfortable starting that conversation off?
Is this on?
Yes.
Well, I think that there's a, as was mentioned in one of the panels yesterday, the CDC is starting to take the issue of primary prevention much more seriously. So there are a number of organizations throughout the country, but it's just beginning where men are actually getting involved and challenging these beliefs and attitudes. And it's sort of like this thing that happened out in California a couple of years ago where this young woman was raped at a high school and gang raped, and all of these other kids are standing around cheering and taking pictures of it. Well, how does that happen? I mean, those kinds of beliefs and attitudes, I mean, it's going to take a fundamental change in how men relate to boys and some of the things you were talking about, just the messages that our culture gives. So I would like to, I know in Minnesota there's talk about how comprehensive sex ed has been held back from a lot of school districts, but we can do that. We can also have a comprehensive healthy relationship programs for schools. There's lots of things that we can do, but it's an area that we just haven't had much of a dialogue about.
Catherine, I know at the Office on Violence Against Women, you all had been involved in a couple of newer initiatives. Is that correct with some of the sports franchises in the United States?
Right, and I think particularly in connection with college campuses, and I was really, I wouldn't say pleased, but I was glad that Paula raised the issue about the University of Virginia episode, which in my mind, and in the minds of so many of us, I think could have been prevented. Going along the lines of what Michael was talking about, I think that if we begin to, whether it's with college and high school athletes, boys and girls, men and women, begin to talk about this early. I do think the future of the VAWA is about prevention, and it is about not just raising awareness, but raising our consciousnesses so that we can act in the same way that we would have in the 1960s if we saw something happening that was racist. I think it's upon behooves all of us to teach our children to intervene and to take a stand. But when you see something that really worries you, like I'm sure the students at University of Virginia did, that they have the courage and they have a place to go and talk about it and figure out what to do about it. And I think that has to be the future of the VAWA. And in part, I'm really thrilled that I'll be working in the coming years at the Office of Juvenile Justice, because I think prevention is where this is. And when you talk about girls who are being initiated into gangs and raped into gangs, we can do something about that in high schools and in colleges, and frankly, in elementary and middle schools.
Yep, I hear you.
You know, Chris, I wanted to mention that part of our work with men is about their experiences growing up and witnessing violence and the kind of trauma that men have experienced and the few resources that were available as young men grew up for them to disclose trauma. I particularly think about the intersection between domestic violence and child sexual abuse. And I'm sure some of you are looking at that, but part of our work with men, I think, is about that piece. Where do they go with those experiences that they had in violent homes? But the second piece I wanted to mention is that the Vice President has talked about this whole issue of cultural change and the voices of men from the very beginning. And I'm not sure that I even really remember that until recently. He was going to visit the Center for Abuse Prevention in Peoria, Illinois, so we sat down to think about what he wanted to say to the group. And he remembered the 1988 Rhode Island study of 1,700 youth and their attitudes towards sexual violence. And that was so appalling to him that it was played a major role in shaping his thinking about the Violence Against Women Act. The study was replicated about 10 years later with similar findings. And so he's always thought about it, and so we have an opportunity now to think about it again and move forward into the future with these prevention messages.
Karen, I'm thinking about all of the sexual assault victims that you've worked with over the many years that you've been doing your work, and I'm wondering if there are any areas of sexual assault that are emerging, different trends that you're seeing in the types of victims that you are treating.
Well, unfortunately, I think we need to enhance the training that is given to service providers like myself. I mean, just at lunch, we were having conversations about trafficking. And I've done over 600 exams, and I'm sure I've examined women who've been victims of trafficking. But I didn't screen for that. The conversations never came up. I mean, these things are going on right next door to where we live, and we're not recognizing this. So I think when we start to look at programs, we need some sort of standardization about curricula that we're using to train healthcare providers, because a lot of people won't disclose victimization in general, but they are more likely to at least talk about some of these things with their doctor or their gynecologist or the nurse that does their physical exam or whoever runs health services on the college campus. So we need to better train healthcare providers for screening, yeah, and not being afraid to ask questions. As healthcare providers, we're always so, we want to be able to fix things. We want to be able to diagnose it and then make it go away. And so when we know there's something we can't fix, we don't ask the question. And we have to be able to look at things differently. So I think a lot of it has to do with training. And as far as providing services, the funding that was earmarked by VAWA, it's wonderful. But in my experience is there are programs that started back in the 90s when my program started. They're no longer in existence because these were startup funds. But we need to look at sustainability. So what does it take to keep really good programs up and running? What do we need to do to get brand new programs off the ground? We all hear things like multidisciplinary teams, sexual assault response teams, family justice centers. How can we really get those good concepts, those programs that have been proven to work? How can we get them to everyone? Because, you know, access to services shouldn't be the luck of the draw of where you live. It should be something that everybody has access to.
Yeah.
I know I went past your question, but I couldn't help it.
No, I mean, I'll always let you talk as much as you want to, Karen. Barney, and before we take a few questions from the audience, I just wanted to ask you a question. I think one of the most important impacts that VAWA has had, and you touched on this, a couple of you did, is the training of law enforcement officers who are often the first responders to victims of sexual assault and stalking and domestic violence. And I was wondering if you could say something about how can we best engage police chiefs? Because I know that a lot of these culture shifts that need to happen, they need to happen at the top. And do you have any advice for how we can go forward and continue to bring police chiefs into the fold and get them to buy into these issues?
Yeah, I think that, is this on?
Poor Barney, I didn't prepare him for that question.
Is this working?
I think so. Can you hear him?
I think there's a need. I suspect that if you had a room full of police chiefs and you talked about this issue intellectually, you would find very little disagreement about its importance or about its significance. Everybody would agree that this is a priority. But if you drill into the operations of the individual police departments and the amount of training that's devoted to it or the pressure or lack of pressure to clear radio calls, to clear investigations, is that intellectual commitment being matched by operational protocols? That, I think, is the challenge. I think we've moved past, for the most part, I think we've moved past the debate about is this an important issue, is this a valid issue. Somebody pointed out a couple of different things. I think we're beyond that. But there is still, from a line officer's perspective, there is still the frustration. I mean, I can remember arresting men for domestic violence and taking them to the station and still be filling out the report when the victim was standing at the front counter to bail out her husband. He was going to leave before, the suspect was going to leave before I did. So there had to be, you know, that operational protocol needed to change. And I think that's what the focus should be with the police chiefs. It's not a commitment to the idea, but what are their officers actually being asked to do?
How can they do?